Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Hi, thanks for joining. Please make sure you subscribe to follow us on all the various platforms here on the podcast, as well as on YouTube. The stuff we write on Substack, as well as quick takes on Instagram and on Threads. If you're enjoying what we're putting out there, please make sure you're sharing with all your friends and family. And if you have questions or comments about the stuff we're putting out there, please make sure you leave them in comments to us. We'll be more than happy to cover them in future talks. During the summer of 2025, the President of the United States decided to revisit the changes that have been integrated over the past two decades into the fitness evaluations and the understanding about fitness that is occurring within the health and physical education classes within the United States. Part of the decision was to constitute a fitness advisory board, the President's Council of Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition, a board made up almost entirely of former professional athletes. Part of the decision was to instill some of the talking points within the Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA movement, surrounding what should or should not be available for students to eat in the school, and how we should go about doing fitness testing. But the biggest decision was to scrap the 2012 initiative that focused on a program of health promotion for the nostalgia of the fitness challenge, its medals, and its certificates. Which leads to the question that we have to ask. Will it get them off the couch? Well, let's talk about that.
Warning. The following presentation contains information that might contradict what you have previously heard, or believed to be true, about how the human body works, and contains material that is not suitable for closed-minded individuals. Enjoy.
The question seems rhetorical. Will it get them off the couch? But what we're really doing here is trying to take a look at the intentions of the Presidential Fitness Challenge and the misgivings that I have about the current revisionist take on it, and what the intentions of that revisionist take happens to be. When we start looking at this idea about the decisions, about instilling some of that MAHA idea into the fitness challenges, about scrapping what was in the 2012 initiatives for the nostalgia of the fitness challenge, its medals, and its certificates, we have to take a step back and look at, okay, what was the purpose of the fitness challenge? From the inception of the challenge at the beginning of the Cold War, its intention was to be more than just a series of physical tests. Its initiative was to become a national health initiative, to be a rite of passage for school-aged children. For generations of those school children, that Presidential Fitness Challenge evokes a multitude of feelings, from pride to anxiety to outright dread. The challenge has left an indelible mark on millions of us. Was it a brilliant catalyst for national health, for physical literacy, or is it a flawed system that inadvertently alienated and shamed a significant portion of its participants? Let's dissect its historical context, the practical implications, and the enduring impact in light of the recent changes that have been insisted upon by the current administration within the United States. Why the challenge? While the origin of the Presidential Fitness Challenge stems from the anecdotal observations of American youth in the decades following World War II, in an article that I continually see cited but does not exist, and the article that continually gets cited is by Cross and Pruden, Comparison of Fitness of Danish and American School Children in Research Quarterly of the American Association of Health Education and Recreation. That study is not present in the journal. I repeat, that study is not present in that journal. There is a separate study by Knutton that looks at the exact same title in terms of comparing Danish and American school children. It's excessively limited in terms of its comparison, but yet every internet source, every article that I see about the reconstitution of the fitness challenge goes back and cites Cross and Pruden. The idea of the fitness testing and establishing fitness norms, however, goes back to the late 1800s and early 1900s with the establishment of the Kreutzweber fitness test, which is a test of muscle coordination and the ability to get up off of the ground. That fitness test, as well as a variety of other fitness tests used by various types of military organizations and branches of the military, which includes that infamous burpee test that we've talked about previously, that has recently become a popular fitness training method that was never supposed to be a fitness training method, that we see as being very, very popular across a whole host of realms of the fitness communities, with a host of the fitness experts claiming that it's something that should be involved with any type of training regimen. Even though the intention of that burpee test, as we've talked about previously, was to measure cardiorespiratory and cardiometabolic fitness for individuals going into the military service, particularly for individuals who were of low level of activity coming into military service. Even though we've had these fitness tests prior, even though we've had some anecdotes about inequality in levels of fitness, it was in the post-war time that the growth and prosperity brought changes to the levels of physical activity that were accompanied by changes in food availability, most of the food availability now being labeled as fast or convenient foods, foods that we have recognized containing various types of potential metabolic disruptors, where we have this change in diet, change in physical activity that have led to changes in overall fitness levels, changes that were cited by Bonnie Pruden and others in support of the anecdotes that American children were somehow less fit than their Western European counterparts, anecdotes that were supposedly supported by that research from Cross and from Pruden, that supposedly noted that 50% of American children that were tested failed to meet minimum standards on the various fitness tests, compared to 8% of the European children that failed the same test. Yet I must point out that even though it is one of the most prominent cited references, it does not exist, with a study from Knutten indicating that the differences that were seen between the Danish children and the American children were present, but did not stipulate that there was a specific cause for those differences, just that there were differences noted in between the Danish children and the American children, with speculation coming into play about diet and about physical activity. It was Bonnie Pruden and Hans Kruse and others that got the attention of then-President Dwight D. Eisenhower. What the president did was establish the President's Council on Youth Fitness in 1956, the intention of which was to encourage less watching of television, eating less prepackaged foods, and exercising more. That is, watch less television, eat more whole food, exercise more often. Yes, history is repeating itself with the current talking points coming out of MAHA, coming out of Make America Healthy Again. Still, the intention for that effort was what laid the groundwork for JFK to expand upon with the initiatives in the 1960s. When he was chided by an article he read in Sports Illustrated, the quote, soft American, end quote, that's the title of the article, linking that idea of Americans becoming soft directly to national strength and resilience during the Cold War, in which JFK argued that a generation of physically unfit people would leave the nation vulnerable, both militarily and ideologically, and that there needs to be an effort from childhood onward to embed the ideals of physical prowess, physical fitness, as being something virtuous for all Americans to achieve, a sentiment that is echoed in the current push to revise the movement away from a program of health promotion and health education to one focusing on physical capacities. The philosophical underpinning about the necessity for expressing feats of physical strength against having overall health gave birth to the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. From this council was born the Presidential Physical Fitness Award, also known as the Presidential Fitness Challenge. The first challenge was launched in 1966 with the aim to set a national standard for youth fitness, identify those that have exceptional athletic potential, and motivate children not only to achieve the standards, but exceed it. The award was based on meeting or exceeding the age and gender-based standards for 6 tests meant to be instruments of one's physical prowess. Those tests, the 50-yard dash, the shuttle run, pull-ups for the boys, flexed arm hangs for the girls, sit-ups in a minute, and the mile run. Achieving certain percentiles and percentile thresholds across all the tests earned participants a coveted patch or a certificate, rewards that were meant to be emblems of their physical prowess, where the percentile threshold was set at meeting and exceeding the 85th percentile for known standards. And as we will get to in a while, the number of tests might have changed, the types of tests might have changed, but the standard of meeting expectations, that 85th percentile, has always remained. The good, the bad, and the ugly. What can we take away as positives and negatives of the fitness challenge? The Presidential Fitness Challenge, in its heyday, possessed a compelling set of advantages and achieved several commendable goals. That's the good. What did it do? It elevated national awareness, particularly national awareness about health. It forced parents, educators, and policymakers to acknowledge the growing issues of inactivity among children. It moved physical education from a peripheral activity to a recognized component of a well-rounded education and spurred widespread public discourse about health initiatives. It promoted physical activity and promoted goal setting. It introduced the concepts of setting and working towards tangible fitness goals, a valuable life skill that provided intrinsic and extrinsic motivation that encouraged regular physical activity, even if it was just during the weeks leading into the annual test, but could serve as a means for determining whether or not progress was being made towards health initiatives. It established a baseline, and it allowed us to track progress. The standardized test allowed schools, and indeed the nation, to collect data, and that data allowed for tracking of progress on a year-to-year basis and identify general trends within schools and within school districts. The data was instrumental in shaping physical education curricula, and shaping physical education criteria, and understanding about national youth health. It fostered healthy competition and camaraderie. The activities in the test within the challenge allowed for healthy competition, thrilling race against classmates, but it also allowed for collective encouragement, such as cheering on your classmate during the pull-ups. It allowed for a shared sense of accomplishment, particularly when you're looking at trying to complete that mile run, all of which built camaraderie amongst the classmates. It provided a platform for students to shine in non-academic settings, particularly for those that do not shine in academic settings. It allowed for a source of pride and a boost of self-esteem. Self-esteem and pride that was necessary in order to offset the feelings of inadequacies that might be felt elsewhere within the school system. It allowed for early identification of athletic talent. The challenges have a potential to serve as an informal talent scout. It allowed exceptional performances to be highlighted and could potentially lead students towards organized sports or specialized training. This is a key benefit, particularly for underserved communities and underrepresented individuals within the school system, particularly where formal sports programs may be less accessible. It instilled a sense of shared experience and identity. That Presidential Fitness Challenge became a pervasive cultural phenomenon. For decades, millions of children across diverse backgrounds participated and were generating shared experiences, a common cultural touchstone that unified children across generations and within generations. The tests themselves are excessively simple and are highly accessible. The exercises that were being tested were fundamental movements: running, jumping, pushing, pulling. They required very little complex instruction, and they made it very easy for PE teachers to implement with minimal specialized equipment. It made it accessible to almost all schools, regardless of their budget or their facilities. Despite the lofty ambitions and some undeniable success, the Presidential Fitness Challenge is not without significant drawbacks and shortcomings. Over time, these criticisms amounted, leading to substantial revisions and eventually a complete overhaul, a set of changes that the current administration is attempting to undo. This includes the one-size-fits-all flaw. The most potent criticism that is inherent is the lack of individualization. The challenge is applied to all children at the same standard, regardless of genetic predispositions, body type, developmental stage, or any type of limitations that might be there. An approach that fails to recognize the diversity of forms, the diversity we have in fitness, and disproportionately favors certain types of body types, certain types of athletic children. Shame and alienation. This is arguably the most damaging legacy for the challenge. Children who struggled, those who couldn't do a single pull-up, those who will always last in the mile run, or fail to meet the thresholds. The public nature of the test could be humiliating. Being singled out for poor performance, or worse, being the only one left without a patch, led to feelings of inadequacy, led to feelings of embarrassment, led to feelings of shame. The very program designed to promote fitness inadvertently created a cohort of individuals who dreaded exercise and foster a lifelong aversion to physical activity or going to the gym, rather than encouraging it. Worse, it also instilled within some individuals a sense that PE does not have a place within the educational system. It focused on performance over health. The challenge was heavily skewed towards athletic performance rather than health-related fitness by focusing on the outcomes of the event rather than the process leading up to the outcomes of the event, worrying more about achieving a specific number of pull-ups or a fastest mile time that did not necessarily equate to a good cardiovascular health, a good musculoskeletal health, a healthy body composition, or positive exercise habits that would encourage the child to train for life as opposed to train for the test. Train to achieve a high score rather than combat the sedentary lifestyle, where the child was encouraged and received positive feedback that led them to train intensely for the test, but then would revert back to sedentary lifestyle, having learned very little about sustainable health practices and what it means to have a pro-health lifestyle. It narrowly defined fitness. It presented a very limited view of what it meant to be physically capable and physically fit. The challenge primarily measured muscular endurance, speed, cardiovascular endurance, while largely ignoring other crucial components of fitness, things like flexibility, balance, coordination, agility, and body composition. A narrow definition that has the potential to be a negative reinforcer, as a child with excellent balance or excellent coordination might still perform poorly on the tests and be labeled as unfit. Or a larger child that might run slow on the 1 mile may exhibit excessive levels of strength, but still be labeled unfit. It propagated gender stereotypes, particularly in early iterations of the challenge, particularly in regards to pull-up versus flexed-armed hangs. Later versions tried to diversify options, but the initial setup sent a clear message about what was expected in terms of physical capacities based off of the socially identified gender of the individual, which was both limiting and biologically inaccurate. There was a risk for injury from overexertion. The pressure to perform, whether coming from the teacher, from peers, or self-imposed pressure, could override sensible precautions, especially for children who were not regularly active, where the competitive environment can cause some children to push themselves beyond safe limits, sometimes used in proper form, leading to musculoskeletal injuries or worse. Lack of equity and lack of resources. Schools in affluent areas often had better equipped gyms, more experienced PE teachers, and resources to prepare students to be more active than in areas of less affluence. Less fortunate schools might have struggled with outdated equipment, larger class sizes, and fewer opportunities for extracurricular physical activity performances, this leading to a lower overall score for the students and exacerbating existing disparities. Outdated metrics and outdated science. Over the decades, the scientific understanding of childhood development, exercise physiology, and health-related fitness has evolved significantly. The original test, while groundbreaking at the time, became increasingly out of date. New research has emphasized the importance on sustained activity, healthy lifestyle choices, and individualized approaches over benchmark-based competitive performances. The evolution of the challenge, from performance to health and back to performance. The legacy of the Presidential Fitness Challenge is a mixed bag. It successfully raised national awareness about youth fitness, provided a framework for measuring it, it inspired millions to push their physical limits, and foster a sense of healthy competition and shared experience. However, its rigid, performance-based design also created an environment of shame, discouragement for many, inadvertently turning many children away from physical activity for good. The criticisms leveled against the physical fitness challenge, until very recently, have been ignored. It's important to understand that ever since the inception of the challenge, the program has undergone significant revisions. Some revisions have reflected political desires and messaging. Some revisions, such as the current ones undertaken, are based on revisionist understanding of what it means to be healthy and what it means to be fit. While most have been based on improvements in understanding about human physiology and methods to improve health, wellness, and fitness that were meant to address shortcomings from the original aim of measuring physical prowess as an indication of fitness, changes in understanding that the current administration wishes to unwrite or undo, as it does not align with their bias regarding health, regardless of fitness, regarding the projections of physical prowess or understanding of historical precedents or scientific knowledge. Beginning in the late 1970s and taking hold in the pantheon of public health opinions in the 1980s and 1990s, the program began a crucial shift from solely performance-based metrics to incorporating a more health-centric and health-related components into the test. This meant focusing on other factors seen as having an impact on one's overall health, such as body composition, flexibility, aerobic capacity, and muscle strength. This meant adding to the previous lists of the tests. Tests of physical performance, measurements of body mass index, BMI, adding activities like sit and reach, and the use of selected tests, the 1 mile run, the shuttle runs, as a determinant of objective measures of cardiorespiratory and cardiometabolic fitness, the VO2 max, but also muscle strength, such as utilizing a hand grip test. It was also during this time that President Reagan and George H.W. Bush rebranded the fitness test to the President's Challenge, a rebrand that offered a broader array of activities and recognized participation and effort, not just elite performance, and that introduced different award levels to encourage more children to continue progression at improving their overall fitness as opposed to discouraging participation by not meeting specific metrics. A subsequent rebrand occurred during the Obama administration when in 2012, the Challenge and Fitness Awards took on the moniker the Presidential Youth Fitness Program. This was not simply a rebrand or a modification to the existing slate of tests as what took place in the 1980s and early 1990s. It was, for all intents and purposes, a complete overhaul, primarily to align with the political agenda of the administration and the First Lady's initiatives surrounding what it meant to have healthy eating habits and a desire to have children just move more, and just move more during the school day. Efforts that were done in response to the 20 years of epidemiological data indicating that even with 50 years of the fitness challenge and awards, there was a pandemic of overfat and overweight children throughout the school system of the United States. Efforts and suggestions that aligned with what was understood about the physiology and pathophysiological impacts that sedentary behavior and the impacts of some foods being consumed, shifts in macro and micronutrients in the diet, and the limitations in physical activity in the day have on the individual. Efforts that aligned with my own research that noted that doing anything, modifying diet or modifying exercise patterns, would lead to metabolic improvements in children and adolescents that were overfat and susceptible to diabetic issues. The work was done in partnership with the Cooper Institute, where there was a movement away from performance-based towards a comprehensive health-related fitness assessment, what was referenced as the fitness gram, while still assessing fitness and assessing fitness with the focus on not meeting or exceeding standards based on military readiness or athletic prowess, but on being medically established within healthy fitness zones. That is, They were not tested to be ready for military duty, not tested to have athletic prowess, but tested so as to meet what was established as healthy fitness zones for body composition as measured with BMI, something we talked about as being an erroneous measure, but also with aerobic fitness, muscle strength, muscle endurance, and flexibility. The emphasis of assessment here was focused on individual health education, and self-improvement, not competition for awards and for medals. It is in response to that movement in 2012 that the current administration is attempting to reverse course from this more health-centric, scientifically backed approach to the fitness assessments and fitness measures to one that is once again focused on rank order challenges, not on being fit, but on showing selected physical prowess on distinct tests of strength and athletic performance as a measure of fitness. A reversal that I must push back against, as it leads to issues that we have been discussing and writing on related to the development of healthy communities and combating long-term impacts of bullying that can rear up in response to performance on tests that the current administration is attempting to coerce us back into using and back into the curriculum within the health and physical education courses nationwide. So what's the take-home message here? The Presidential Fitness Challenge reflects a broader societal evolution in understanding of health and physical education. We've moved away from the Cold War era focus on national vigor and athletic prowess to a more nuanced appreciation of holistic, health-related fitness tailored to the individual needs. A focus on the individual goals of the participants, forming an inclusive and welcoming environment that allows for developing lifelong habits to improve health, improve fitness, with a broader understanding to the definitions of fitness that have moved beyond what someone looks like or what their athletic prowess might be. Unfortunately, the current administration's desire to undo everything that their predecessors have done have developed a way to send us backwards. While the iconic pull-up bar, shuttle run, mile run of the original challenge, once a memory of bygone endeavors, is coming back, its impact may resonate in ways that are not intended. While difficult tasks may teach us invaluable lessons, the requirement that these fitness assessments need to work at promoting national health are being corrupted by political wrangling will have unintended consequences of a well-intentioned but flawed approach. The debate over fitness in school is far from over, but understanding why we have taken the effort, what was done, and what has changed in the standards being assessed will allow us to strike the right balance between setting standards, fostering motivation, and ensuring inclusivity and promoting genuine lifelong health. As this remains the key to the use of the fitness challenge and balance point, that like much of how our body functions is a dynamic challenge, and finding just the right amount, the point of being the baby bear in the efforts, we can and must continue to refine our approach. Strive for a future where everyone feels empowered from their journey towards a fitter, healthier life. A journey that begins with having a challenge that serves as an educational marker and an incentive to continue, not as a ranking system for those that can versus those that cannot. Well, thanks for listening. Hopefully get a bit out of the conversation about this presidential fitness challenge and why we should be objecting to some of the changes that are going to be implemented coming out of this current administration. If you're liking what we're putting out there, please make sure you give us that big 5-star rating, that big thumbs up. Tell us that we're doing a good job. If you have questions or comments, please leave them for us. We'd be more than happy to address them in future conversations, future discussions. Please make sure you're following us here on the podcast. Please make sure you subscribe to follow us on YouTube as well. The written stuff in Substack, as well as the quick takes that we post to Instagram and to Threads. Please stay tuned for future discussions about the myths and misconceptions we have about how our body works, about health, and about healthy lifestyles.